Okay, well, let's start with a little bit of background information. Could you state your full name, please?
Andrew Thompson Seaman.
Okay, and your date and place of birth?
Well, I was born in Pictou County, Nova Scotia, in 1941.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe your educational background?
Well, my family moved to Saxon, Brunswick, actually when I was 2 years old. And we grew up in Sackville, and I went to the Sackville High School in Mount Allison for an undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. I taught school in Ontario for a year and came back to Dalhousie to do a master's. And then I got a lecturing job at St. Mary's immediately after that, which was 1966. Mm-hmm. And then St. Mary's gave me a leave of absence and a little bit of financial aid to go on to my PhD. And I did the residency for the PhD in 1970-72 in Dublin, at University College Dublin. And then eventually went back for a sabbatical and finished up the thesis a little bit later.
So what have your research interests been?
Well, I did my master's in modern poetry. And then, actually, I wrote a thesis on Dylan Thomas. And when I was looking for a place to go for a PhD, and of course, there's some difficulty always getting into a PhD program, unless you're absolutely brilliant, of course, and then they're kind of looking for you. I applied to a number of places. One wanted to get to the British Isles, and I applied to a number of places with some projects based on the MA thesis on Dylan Thomas, and also W.B. Yeats, who I had an interest in at the time. And University College Dublin picked up the Yeats thing and wrote me back and said that they were interested in getting students into their doctoral program in Anglo-Irish Studies, but that they had too many people interested in W.B. Yeats, and would I be interested in doing one of a number of projects that they had available that they wanted researched. And in a way, it was kind of too good an opportunity to pass up, and I was interested in the idea of getting to Ireland itself anyway, so I wrote back and told them, sure, I'll do anything you want me to do. And, we settled on a project eventually on the 19th century Anglo-Irish Romantics, the background of the Celtic Twilight movement, W.B. Yeats and that group. They were strongly influenced by a man by the name of Standish James O'Grady, who had popularized a good deal of the Celtic mythological background that he had picked up from literal translations that a number of his scholarly friends were doing. He didn't actually read Gaelic himself, but he would take these scholarly translations and rewrite them in a popular style. Actually, he transformed them quite basically into 19th century fairy tales, in a sense, with a Victorian morality and all the rest of it, you know, so they're really quite different. But he rewrote them and was one of the primary influences on that turn of the century generation of Irish poets. So I did a thesis on him, and it proved to be very interesting and filled in a lot of material on 19th century Anglo-Irish background that I wouldn't have known otherwise, but I haven't been able to teach that very often. I've taught a couple of courses related to it since I came here. Mm-hmm. I mean, since I returned. But what they needed taught here in our English department was primarily modern poetry, which I taught for a number of years, and then partly because of my connection with the Romantics through the Anglo-Irish stuff, I began to teach the course on English Romanticism here, and I've taught that quite consistently ever since. And then also, we get very interested in maritime literature, several of us in the department here, and Ken McKinnon and I got a course going here in maritime literature, and I've taught that off and on ever since. And most of the material that I've published has actually been in that area. So that really my research that's resulted in publication is almost entirely on maritime literature.
Mm-hmm. So when did that trend to maritime literature start taking place?
Well, there was a great deal of interest developing amongst the maritime universities in the 70s. You might say that Canadian studies generally more or less came of age in the 70s. In the 60s, it was difficult to be taken seriously if you were offering a course, even in Canadian literature at large. Some of the bigger centers, like Toronto, had courses in Canadian literature, but very few of the smaller universities did. And that all changed quite radically through the 60s and into the 70s, so that by the time I came back from doing my PhD studies in Ireland, there was certainly emerging an interest on the part of students, particularly in taking a course that had to do with the literature of the area. And Terry Whalen in the English department had begun an enterprise that became the Atlantic Promises Book Review. And it was published originally through St. Mary's and out of the English department. It later became an independently funded publication. And he became the editor of it as an independently publication for quite a few years. And several of us who were interested in maritime literature got to writing reviews for that publication, and that sort of encouraged us and gave us a bit of an outlet.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I wrote a review article or two for Acadiensis after that, and I submitted an article to Canadian Literature Quarterly, which was accepted, and so on. So gradually, it seemed a worthwhile area to get involved in research and publication in, because it hadn't been done to death by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of fresh, and chance to get in on the ground floor or something.
Mm-hmm.
We were encouraged, of course, to publish. St. Mary's has never been a publisher parish institution, really, except that in recent years it's very difficult to get promoted unless you have a pretty good publication record. But I felt at the time that there really wasn't much point in trying to get into the very strenuous competition for publication in the area of the English Romantics, for instance, to get an article on Keats published in one of the leading British periodicals is an uphill battle. You know, so. However, this was something that we felt was worth doing, you know, because there hadn't been enough research done on maritime literature. A lot of the authors were almost totally unknown. Even authors like Thomas Radell were not very well known, and he has an international reputation, really, but wasn't much thought of or very highly spoken of locally. And so to get some of these authors into a better public view seemed worth doing. Alan Bevan had in the 70s got the University of Toronto Press, for instance, to publish republish Frank Parker Day's novel Rockbound, wrote an introduction for it, and so on. And a number of these reprints were being done, which was getting some of the literature into print again, so that it could be used in courses. You could actually acquire some text. The Canadian the Canadian Library series from McClellan and Stewart was also increasingly putting more maritime material in publication. And Generally speaking, through the 70s and into the 80s, the whole thing began to take on the feeling of a legitimate area of scholarly study. Prior to that, you'd sort of been looked upon as somebody who was really trying to escape from the real academic grind if you indulge in such frivolous things as local literature, you know, but it's coming to its own subsequently.
So what changes have you noticed in the English department since 1966?
Well, I was the fifth member of the department, or David Piggott and I were the fourth and fifth members of the department in 1966, and I'm now 18. That's quite a change.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 70s, it was an entirely different scene from anything in the 80s, or certainly in the 90s. The university was expanding so rapidly that I think one year we hired four people. Another year we hired three, another year we hired two, and so on. Nowadays, or subsequently, in the 80s, the only hiring that was ever done was to replace somebody who retired, or, Mike Larson, when he became Dean of Arts, was really, in 1990, was the only case we had of somebody actually moving into administration who had to be replaced for that reason. And there hadn't been very many retirements. Actually, through the 80s, we virtually hired no one. So that rapid period of expansion in the 70s was quite exciting in a way. And of course, it was a period of very rapid inflation as well. So that salaries went up very rapidly. Of course, the cost of living went up simultaneously and at the same rate, but it meant that a considerable amount of negotiation was required to keep salaries abreast of the cost of living. And also we formed a union, faculty union, in the mid-70s, which became necessary because of inequalities in the pay structure. It was getting to the point where people who'd, well, there was a real disadvantage to have been here for a long time, because you kept getting pay increases, you know, 4% of your salary, 5% of your salary, but when your salary was only $6,000 in the first place, that didn't amount to much, you see. And of course, they were having to bring in people at higher levels subsequently, so sometimes we had a situation in which actually a younger person without the same experience would be making a significant amount more than one of the older regular members of the faculty. And in order to try and straighten this whole thing out, some of us decided that there should be a union here. It was a big decision, because academics, generally speaking, don't like unions, in a general sense, or at least they don't like to become unionized themselves. And there was a strong feeling that it ought to be done through the Canadian University Teachers Association. But there was also a reluctance on the part of the CAUT to do that, to get into the whole business of legal negotiation and bargaining and all that sort of thing. So we devised a strategy here at St. Mary's and called in the Canadian Union of Public Employees to unionize the faculty, because in fact the salaries of university teachers are paid substantially by government grants, and there was a case to be made that we were in fact public employees of a kind, and of course QB was very anxious to get a foothold on the campuses, be prestigious for one thing, and it was an expansion of their territory. So they were gung-ho about that, and they came on campus and began to organize for a union. Well, that really got the CAUT up and going, in response to us bringing the Canadian Union of Public Employees onto the scene, they sort of quickly got organized and countered that with a campaign of their own, and eventually then won out over CUPE on campus, so that in fact the Canadian Association of University Teachers did organize the first union on campus here, and it was one of the first university unions in the Maritimes. But in a sense, it was all a plot. We really didn't care whether it was CUPE or the CAUT that did it, and we would have preferred the CAUT anyway because it was our professional association. So it's a bit of a plot, a bit of a trick, but it worked anyway. And we got organized at that point, then negotiated a salary scale. And because I had been here since 1966 myself and was also suffering from this, 6% of nothing is nothing syndrome, I got a large raise out of the first contract. It would have been about 25% in terms of my salary at the time, which was probably only $3,000 or something, but still, yes. Sounded like a lot of money at the time. And of course, the unions had played a very important role at St. Mary's ever since. I was president of the union in the 70s for a couple of years, which was interesting, to say the least. I found it very strenuous. Mm-hmm. We had several significant cases. The Peter March tenure case came up during my period as president of the union. And that was a long, difficult fight. As president of the union, I defended him, and it was more or less in the same sense as a lawyer taking on a client. If you're the lawyer for the defense, you defend your client to the best of your ability. It's got nothing to do with what you think about the case. Mm-hmm. There were certainly two sides to the March case, all right, but we supported him to the best of our ability, and we eventually won out on that one as well. But it went on for a long time, and eventually came down to board of inquiry being set up, composed of experts from outside the university who decided the question in the final analysis.
Okay. You were here when women first were admitted as a...
Yeah, that's true.
What type of effect did that have on the school?
Oh, it was without question a positive influence. There was no other way that St. Mary's could have gone. I mean, there was no real possibility, in retrospect, one sees there was no real possibility or reason for St. Mary's to remain a purely male college. There are virtually no such things as male colleges nowadays, or women's colleges either for that matter. I mean, Mount St. Vincent has gone equally the other way, admitting male students. Segregated education was simply a thing of the past by that time. Probably St. Mary's hung on longer than it should have. But that was partly due to the fact that it was administered by the Jesuits. When I first came to St. Mary's in 66, Father Fisher was the president. I forget whether there's another one in between Fisher and LaBelle or not. I guess not. Father LaBelle followed Father Fisher. And the Father LaBelle years were quite fun. There was a lot of action. There was the beginning of that big expansion period. The high rises went up at that time, I think. So I've got my chronology straight. And Father LaBelle's regime was known for its lavish faculty dinner dances and parties and things like that. He was he liked to put on a bit of a show in that way. Mm-hmm. And, as a matter of fact, back in those days, we had a lot of faculty parties as well. A number of the Jesuits, particularly in the administration, quite frequently came to faculty social functions and were very much a part of the gang in a sense. But they had seen that the writing was on the wall, certainly with regard to coeducation, and I don't think there was any real opposition to the idea. Mind you, when you've probably heard this story from other people, but when the first female student registered at St. Mary's, it was actually done partly as a stunt, and the girl actually had a boy's name, or a name that could equally apply to either sex, like Francis or something like that. And I forget exactly what her name was. But anyway, she simply registered, and nobody at the time caught on to the fact that this was a girl who was registering. And of course, it was never anything of a, what shall we say, a legal nature that prevented women from registering at St. Mary's University. So there was actually nothing that needed to be done in order to admit them, in a way. It was just a matter of convention and the fact that it had long been accepted that St. Mary's was a male institution. It began as a boys' high school, of course, and gradually sort of made the transition to a college. And, well, I think up until the point at which women started to register here, it had just been generally accepted that it was a male institution. Now, somebody might contradict me about that. It may have been that some official step was taken by the Board of Governors or by Senate, but I rather doubt if anything official was ever done, because there was no reason why they couldn't have registered anyway, really, except that they would have been turned down by the admissions department on the grounds that they were female, and if anybody had chosen to fight it legally, I think probably they would have won. I really don't know. But it happened rather gradually. I wish I could remember that first girl's name. She was actually in my English 200 course at the time. And there wasn't a great stir made about it either. It was more or less accepted. There's no reason why she shouldn't be there even then. Though there were probably some of the old guard who raised their eyebrows a bit, but honestly, I would say that the actuality really came after everybody was mentally prepared for it anyway. I can't imagine even in 68, I think it was 68, when we had the first girl register. I can't imagine even in 68 that anybody would have dared pretend that there was something essentially wrong with this. I mean, it was a silly idea, really, to say, goodness, we cannot have women here, of all things. You know, why not? You know, nobody could have given a sensible, rational answer to the question, why not? So they just shut up about it, you know? Certainly, we weren't the slightest bit surprised or concerned. When I first came in 66, there were actually quite a few professors who wore black gowns to teach.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Don't think I ever saw one in a mortar board, but they were black gowns. And, of course, the argument was, well, keep the chalk off your suit, you know? So, I never did myself, but, well, no, that's not true. I wore a black gown myself the first year. Yeah, I did. I tried to remember way back then, but I had a huge class in Theater A, I think. I think it would have been in the first year. I think Theater A was built then. So the rest of the building was a library at that time. Yeah, I had a huge class at Theater A, nearly 200 students. And, yeah, I can remember whisking in there in my black gown, lecturing away at the front of the room on the history of English literature, starting with Chaucer. It wasn't a bad idea, really. I mean, there's almost a movement to go back to the historical survey approach to introductory English.
Mm-hmm.
Because you sort of feel that somewhere along the line, students ought to come across authors like Chaucer and Milton, some of which they generally don't get if they, unless they become English majors and take a full majors course, and even then it's possible to avoid some of them.
What differences have you noted in the setup of the academic program since 1966, the courses offered and the requirements?
Well, there was very much a tendency in the 70s to move towards this smorgasbord kind of program in which students simply selected whatever they wanted to study, and you had to take so many courses in English to make up a major, and that was about that. But people became rather concerned, I think, fairly soon about the possibility of somebody graduating, presumably an expert in English literature, and really knowing nothing about anything except 20th century English literature, or perhaps 20th century Commonwealth literature, mainly Canadian or something like that. You know, I mean, they didn't. And so we began to introduce requirements such as the English 400 course, the course in poetry, which is intended to make sure that everybody who takes an English major has become acquainted with the major poets of the tradition and knows a certain amount about the terminology of criticism and all this kind of thing. And I think increasingly nowadays there's a concern for putting together more programs with a little more integrity to them. We talk quite a bit in some of our policy sessions. Occasionally the English department will get together for an evening and bash ideas about, talk about what we ought to be doing and so on. And I know it's an increasing tendency for people to talk about the necessity of offering, let's say, instead of simply a fairly open system with one or two required courses in English 400, perhaps a variety, half a dozen programs, a complete set of courses mapped out in each one. The student can choose, let's say, one of these six programs, but at least they get a well-integrated program in the end. And I really think this is a good idea. One of the difficulties is that nobody can know what they want to take before they've taken it in any very detailed way, because you're bound to make discoveries, let's hope.
Mm-hmm.
And you're more likely to get a good cross-sectional view of the area you want to concentrate on if somebody who really knows the material sets up an integrated program for you. Of course, this one attempts to do this through the advising system, but it's never worked that well. It's very spotty. It really depends, and has always depended, on how interested the student is in getting advice. And even though each student is appointed an advisor, it's a rare professor who will actually chase down all the students that are designated and spend time on them and make sure that they have really looked into the program they're taking and all the rest of it, if the student doesn't make any move to do so. And I found that most students don't, really.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they feel that they know what they want to take. So long as they've checked it against the calendar to make sure that it's legit, they let it go at that. So I think there is a tendency in recent years to tighten up the program somewhat.
Okay, what differences have you noticed in the actual student populations besides the change in gender, say in terms of age or ethnic origin?
Well, just in recent years, we're getting a lot more Middle Eastern students, of course, particularly in science and engineering. And The continuing education branch of the university has expanded rapidly in the last 10 years and pulls in a lot of mature students who generally are very good students. I've taught maritime literature in the continuing education division for off and on for a long time. I taught at Truro for quite a few years. And always found that you get a very good group of students, interested, dedicated, always do all the reading, all that kind of thing. And I myself feel that, even looking back on my own career, that probably the ages between 17 and 21 are the worst possible time in your life to get an education. Adults who go back and sort of work through a subject over a longer period of time tend to take it a great deal more seriously and have a broader basis of experience upon which to base their thinking and their reflection and so on. The student who's a really good student in their late teens either very bright or very ambitious, and I think that a lot of others are just involved in so many things, you know, sports and student activities and all that sort of thing, that it's difficult to concentrate on studies. So that I view the whole sort of development of adult studies as a very good thing for education generally, really. I've always sort of taken the attitude, which is by no means unique to me, that it's not so much what you actually learn at university that matters as learning the value of education and how to acquire information when you want it, when you need it, and so on. So that really, the university education ought to be a basis for continuing a sort of lifestyle that's centered around development of the life of the mind throughout life. And if it's not that, it's really not university education so much as it is some kind of job qualification. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So do you feel that that's changed over the years, what students expect to receive from a university education?
I think they're more demanding. They've become more demanding over the years. And it's certainly become more acceptable and more the general practice for people of all ages to attend university. I know when I was in university in the late 50s and early 60s, the presence of an older student in class was really very unusual and a bit startling. Perhaps a bit disconcerting to some people. But one thing's nothing of it at all now, I'm sure. I don't anyway, but I don't think that I don't see any indication that the students notice or care what person's age is in classroom anymore. And certainly it always makes a contribution to have some older members of the group.
So the numbers of students going through the university has greatly increased as well during all these years.
Oh, yeah.
What effect do you think that's had on your relationship with your students?
Well, it's bound to be somewhat detrimental, and there's no way to get around that. I remember, I think it was the second year that I was here, I had it would have been 67, 68, 69. Probably 68, 69, I guess. I had a group it was the first year that I taught English 416 at any rate, and I had a group of about a dozen students in that class, and we formed a very sort of close unit over the year. A couple of those students I'm still in touch with. on a sort of a Christmas card basis and drop in if you happen to be in the area. One of them lives down in Manchester, Vermont. And I drop in, see him and his wife anytime I'm going through Vermont and so on. And, you know, I remember all their names to this day, and we had a very sort of productive and friendly relationship. Conducted the thing as a seminar exclusively. I mean, the students did most of the work, which, you know, I directed and gave them projects to look into and so on. But I didn't lecture in that course at all, actually. Just sort of led discussions. And it was a really nice atmosphere. I kind of look back upon it as the golden days, you know, the best possible kind of a class you could have. And from there on, the classes gradually got bigger. So that anytime I've taught English 416 recently, I've had 45 to 55 students in it. Creates an entirely different situation, but all you can do is lecture. So one attempts to develop as much of a rapport as you can, but certainly there's some danger that the St. Mary's St. Mary's attitude of being a personalized university and the university where your student faculty ratios are good and so on is in danger of becoming something of a myth.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's entirely economics. Student numbers at the university have doubled, what, in the last 10 or 12 years? And the faculty certainly hasn't. It's increased by maybe 20%. I mean, those figures are available somewhere, but the result is that we all have at least, well, close to twice as many students as we used to. And in some cases, a great deal more than that. For some reason or other, in English, there seem to be a larger percentage of students taking English majors. We seem to have a very large group in there. I don't know exactly why it's happening, because it's not exactly job-oriented. Of course, commerce has a big following because it's more likely to result in employment.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe students who are taking general arts degrees tend to opt for English as a major because it's a familiar subject and broad, in a sense. And it's likely to bring them into contact with quite a wide variety of writing experience. So it's attractive for that reason. But anyway, the percentage of art students taking English has steadily risen as well, so that some of our classes are getting unmanageably big, really, at this point. Which is kind of too bad. I don't know what you can do about it. We have still one of the biggest departments in the university, and to make it a lot bigger yet is simply an economic and political impossibility. When you have one of the biggest departments in the university and you ask for another three or four professors, people look at you and say, well, you need three or four. You're already the biggest department in the university. The government support for students, the per capita grants and so on, haven't gone up at anything like the rate that the salaries and costs of running the university have gone up. So that St. Mary's literally has had to expand without increasing its faculty a great deal in order to simply keep level, keep balance the books.
Mm-hmm.
Mind you, St. Mary's has managed to balance the books all the way through these years. Even when we built the tower, I was on the building committee. I was a member of the Board of Governors at the time. I was on the building committee for the tower, and I think that a really good job was done on that. We had some pretty informed members of the board who were pretty shrewd about getting the right architect and the right company and all the rest of it. And we built it for a good price, and at the time had to borrow some money in order to complete it, but they knew where the money was going to come from. Pledges on the financial campaign and so on, and the money did materialize, and that small deficit was paid off again. So really, St. Mary's University has no capital debt, and is one of the few universities that can boast that.
Mm-hmm.
It's been fairly shrewdly administered financially, and a lot of the credit goes to Guy Noel, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We love to fight with you, of course, but that's the name of the game. When I was president of the union, of course, and negotiating with Guy on the other side of the table, things even came to the point of mild insults at times, but everybody knew we didn't really mean them, and Guy and I always remained on the best of terms, really. And I've always had a considerable amount of respect for the way he's sort of headed up the financial end of the university. And he has some tricks by which he does that, no question about it. But you have to. You have to maintain control over a budget if you're going to keep it in the black. If you start doing all the things you should be doing, you're going to run into the red for sure. There's just no alternative. And I believe that St. Mary's hasn't done all the things that it should do, but I think quite possibly it's done most of what it could do by way of increasing faculty and generally improving facilities.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good little university. I've become quite attached to it over the years. took a while, in a sense, to develop a sense of belonging to St. Mary's University. Even the name was foreign to me, in a sense, because I was brought up Protestant. And this was a very Catholic institution. It surprised me when I was hired in 1966 that nobody even asked me what my religion was, but that was true. They didn't. By that point, the Jesuits had come to realize that a university couldn't remain strictly Catholic in any in that sense, at any rate.
Mm-hmm.
And that in order to keep abreast of the times and get in the kind of faculty they wanted, they would have to simply hire on the basis of academic qualifications. So it wasn't even an issue back in 1966. And of course, since then, the faculty has become predominantly lay. Well, it's become entirely lay now, really, except for three or four individuals. And I would say probably predominantly agnostic rather than any particular religion at all, for that matter. Though there is certainly a core of specifically Catholic professors. Still something of an old guard around in that regard.
That's about all I had to cover. I see anything
to make. Yeah. Well, I don't know if I offered anything you can use, but no, I don't know. Things will come to me, no doubt, that I might have told you, but I don't. I don't know. If you interview enough people, you're bound to